Could we just read one verse from the Bible to introduce what I have to say tonight, and that's in Hebrews chapter 13 and part of verse 7 and verse 8. The letter to the Hebrews toward the end of your New Testament, and the 13th chapter. And we pick up in the middle of verse 7. Hebrews 13 and verse 7. Whose faith follow, considering the end of their conversation, or their way of life. Jesus Christ, the same, yesterday and today and forever. Whose faith follow, considering the end of their conversation, their way of life. Jesus Christ, the same, yesterday and today and forever. The man Paul mentioned, William Burns, was something, one of the greatest missionaries who ever lived. On our shelves at the back, you may be able to find it. I couldn't see it tonight, but it's somewhere tucked among the books for borrowing, is a little book, Revival Sermons by William Burns. But in his short life, he served God, I suppose, more fully than many scores of people put together. His life fell into two clear parts. There was his work in the land of Scotland as a younger man, and his work in China in his 30s and onward. The work in Scotland was a powerful, dynamic work. It reminds one of those streams that takes its rise up in the mountains and rushes down as a torrent that's irresistible. And then as it comes to the plains, it gradually turns into a smooth-running river, wide broadening out till it reaches the estuary. That was like William Burns. We'll see as we look at his life. I think God sometimes makes certain Christians outstanding in a special way to set them up as beacon lights for his people, sometimes sadly warning, but sometimes for encouragement. Now, this is a man who we cannot imitate, a special man for a special work. But the scripture we read reminds us that it isn't the details of these people's lives that we try to copy. For example, he was a bachelor. The austerity and simplicity he imposed in his life was possible only for a single man. For people in ordinary life, much of what he did would be impossible. But whose faith followed. The driving principle behind him was that faith that every believer can cultivate. Well, we look at him in fairly clear divisions. There was his beginning, his conversion. There was his work in Scotland, his preparatory work. There was his work in China, and a very, very beautiful closing scene of his life out there. Child of the manse. Like so many of these great men, he came from a family of ministers. Families like the Boners, families like the Burns, noted generations back for godly ministers. And he was the fifth child, growing up in a quiet country parish, later moving at the age of 12 to Kilsyth, which is 12 miles east of Glasgow, a fairly busy, small, active industrial town. As a boy, he grew up loving the countryside, strong, powerfully built, great one for fishing in Carron Water, loving to wield an axe when the men were clearing the trees, helping the farming, the haymaking, the harvesting, his whole life set on being a farmer. But when he was 12, an uncle visited them, and he looked at this boy and he said to his father, the minister, he said, "William is a boy of special parts. And let me take him to Aberdeen, to the grammar school." He was a lawyer from Aberdeen. And his father took him. His father let him go. And there, at Aberdeen, he came under the influence of a very famous classical scholar at that grammar school, and developed a love for learning, and went on at the age of 16, at the age of 14, I think it was, to Aberdeen University for his final 2 years of preliminary education, and came back a different boy, not a Christian. But he now looked down on the idea of becoming a farmer. He had been moving among the children of professional classes, and he was going to be a lawyer. Because, as he said quite simply, lawyers live in big houses and are rich. And so he came back home at the age of 16 with that as his goal in life. Now his father was grieved. He had given that boy to the Lord for the ministry. And the boy was set in going to Edinburgh to take up articles of law. And as his father knew, that would bind him to the world for life. But God stepped in. He had a sister, Jane, older than him. And 1831 was a year of grace for that house. Because Jane had spent 2 giddy years in Edinburgh society till God took her and brought her to himself. And she came back home to live with her father in the manse, with one desire only, to devote her life to God. And she began, with the rest of the family, after dinner, to read. And they would read together books like Bridges on Proverbs and godly books. Whenever they opened these books, William would slip out. He had no taste for that at all. And so off he went to Edinburgh to take up articles of law with the world at his feet. He was a clever, able boy. He had been a prize winner at school, and he seemed set for a fine career. December 1831, after dinner, the door opened and William came in. He stood with his back to the fire and he looked at them. And his mother said, "Where have you come from, William?" He said, "I come from Edinburgh." "How did you come?" "I walked 36 miles. And he said, "Mother, what would you think if I became a minister after all?" You see, something had happened. While he was in lodgings in Edinburgh, certain things happened. The certificates necessary for his articles were delayed, and that was all held up. And while that was happening, cholera swept the town. And sudden death became a very real possibility for anybody. He still had maintained his Sabbath keeping and was listening to sound preaching. And his father had sent him a book, given him a book when he left home. And his sisters had sent him books to read on the Sabbath. And one day his sister wrote to him and said something to this effect, that they were going as pilgrims to Zion, and it grieved them to think of leaving him behind. And that pierced him. He said later, he said, "I could quite easily think of leaving Christ, because I didn't know him. But I loved my family, and I loved that godly home, and my godly parents. And the thought of leaving them broke my heart." And God began to work through those various things. And one Sabbath afternoon, he was reading a book given to him by his father, a book called Early Piety. And suddenly, he says, an arrow from the quiver of the King of Zion was shot by sovereign power into his heart. And he left the room where he was and went upstairs to his bed. And there he poured out his heart with tears to God, crying for salvation. He said later that God had saved him, a sovereign, gracious God had saved him, and he knew at once that the rest of his life must be given to the preaching of the gospel. He was 17. Well, the result was he came back. He had no articles to relinquish. He went back to Aberdeen University, this time because in those days this was necessary if he wanted to enter the ministry. He went to take his degree to qualify for a degree in divinity later so that he could become a minister in the Church of Scotland. But now it was a different William Burns who went to Aberdeen University. Everything he did from now on had one aim behind it: the glory of God. A true Christian, he became a more devoted student than ever. He became a prize winner in Greek at the university and an expert in Hebrew. He took his degree and then went on to Glasgow University to study for divinity, And to cut it a long story short, in 1839 he was ordained by the Church of Scotland to preach at the age of 24 years. God had prepared somebody for a work. It's wonderful, isn't it? Again, you can think of those prayers that waited for many years to be answered. There are many children in this church who are prayed for. Many young people who are prayed for, and often it seems they're going headlong along paths of their own choosing. God will work, and we pray he may. He was wondering what to do, because at university he had been fired with a desire for missionary service. He had offered himself to the society that ordered these things for service in India. But at that time they had no openings, and he waited on at college for a few months wondering what to do. And just at that time, April 1939, you may remember that Robert Murray McShane with Andrew Boner and Dr. Black and one other had gone, were going to the Holy Land. And Murray McShane said to William Burns, "Would you come and preach for me while I'm away at my church in Dundee?" And he felt that was a call that he should obey, and there he went. Now, Murray McShane was one of the most highly respected young ministers in Scotland, a man whose godliness was awesome. And when his congregation saw this young boy they brought him, just 24 years of age, step into the pulpit at St. Peter's in Dundee, their hearts trembled for him. But when he prayed his opening prayer, those fears disappeared. As one of them said, you could hear his master's footsteps behind him. Because from the moment of his conversion, William Burns was a man of private prayer. His whole life was governed by communion with God in private. And he preached. He preached with power at Dundee, and the fruit of McShane's work there began to be evident. And for the next 3 months he preached at Dundee, and God blessed it. In a quiet way, soul after soul were converted. But God had other things in mind. And in the August of that year, things happened in a remarkable way that moved him from Dundee to Kilsyth, his hometown. He was a powerful preacher. They said he was gifted with a very vigorous understanding. He had a voice of power and range, they said, that exceeded Spurgeon's later. He had physical strength and presence. He was not at all emotional. There was nothing imaginative, nothing romantic, simply a clear view of the truth of God and a relentless pursuit of that truth by solid argument. He had no interest in pleasing people, and wherever he preached, before him was the glory of God, and as a means to that glory, the salvation of souls. He was fitted for intense activity. Later, in the height of his preaching, he could preach for 5 hours, lie down and go to sleep like a child and wake up refreshed to go on. He could so detach himself. God gave him those abilities. He had with all his intensity of preaching, he had a humble, childlike, friendly nature that could mingle with people and with children especially. They say that he was gifted with an extraordinary degree of common sense. Somebody said of him that no man was less of a fool by nature, but no man became a fool for Christ more than he did. And that was the man that was led by God to preach at Kilsyth. Now, Kilsyth had an interesting history. In 1741, nearly 100 years before, God had done a remarkable work at Kilsyth and Cambuslang. You read the history of it in a little book on our shelves called When the Wind Blows, the ministry of James Robe, when scenes of tremendous blessing visited that town. Hundreds of people were converted in a mighty wave of blessing. There were still people living in Kilsyth who prayed and prayed God would do it again. And his own father, who had been minister there for 18 years, was a man who had prayed that God would visit Kilsyth again. Burns went to Kilsyth partly because in the latter part of July his brother-in-law suddenly died, a godly man. And deeply moved, he stood by his graveside, and it seemed as though God was touching William Burns to unlock, as it were, the gift that God had given him of evangelism. It was communion time, and large numbers of people converged on the church at Kilsyth for the communion service. On the day or two before, William Burns had been asked to preach locally, and such was the power of his preaching that his uncle, who was due to preach at Kilsyth on the Sabbath, said, I'm not going to preach, you must preach in my place. And he preached on the Sabbath with great power. But as he stood looking at that congregation and thinking of his childhood in that town when he was ungodly, he announced at the end of the service that on the Tuesday at 10 o'clock in the open air, he would speak to the people of Kilsyth before he went back to Dundee and from thence overseas to the mission field. It might be the last time he would preach to them. Now this caught the imagination of the town, and an enormous crowd of people who would never enter a church gathered at 10 o'clock on the Tuesday morning. As God would have it, it began to rain, so they had to move into the church for cover. And there, with every stairway, every gallery, every chair, every aisle packed with people, he began to preach. It was a scene that was never to be forgotten. That vast crowd, as he preached, standing riveted in solemn, silent attention. And then he felt the urge, the impression, to press upon them at that moment their need of conversion and to ask them to come to Christ now. I'll just read you in his own account what happened. While I was speaking, the people listened with the most riveted attention, many silent tears and inward groanings of spirit. But at the last their feelings became too strong and broke forth simultaneously in weeping, in tears, in groans, intermingled with shouts of joy and praise from some of the people of God. The appearance of the greater part of the people from the pulpit gave me an awfully vivid picture of the state of the ungodly in the day of Christ's coming to judgment. Some were screaming out in agony. Others, among these strong men, fell to the ground as if they had been dead. And such was the general commotion that I was obliged to give out a psalm, which soon was joined by a considerable number, our voices being mingled with the mourning groans of many prisoners sighing for deliverance. The service concluded at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, having lasted 5 hours. It didn't leave a fleeting impression. God was moving in that town. And then, from then on, after Burns had gone back, using other ministers, his father and others, soul after soul was saved, hundreds of people were converted. Burns had to go back to Dundee, and there God worked in exactly the same way. The blessing that had been quietly building up broke out in a revival of remarkable proportion. And so, for the moment, thoughts of missionary work were out of his mind. He felt the call to preach the gospel, and many others joined with him, sound ministers in the churches he went to. He went, Dundee saw tremendous blessing. The church thronged every night of the week. 20, 30, 40 people inquiring at his lodging about their souls every day. And other ministers having to be called in to help, to deal with the people seeking salvation. He moved on to Perth. He was now 25 years old. He had been preaching for 1 year. There he saw exactly the same thing. Opposition from the unsaved ministers, fellowship with the godly, and blessing upon blessing in salvation. He went on from there to Edinburgh. He preached throughout the Highlands. The accounts of his preaching in the Highlands are remarkable. He was a very powerful, strong man and an excellent rider. And he went by horseback tremendous distances, preaching in the areas of the highlands. Wherever he went, thousands would gather, and again the gospel would be preached and souls saved. He came back to Edinburgh in 1841 because his friend Moody Stewart was having to go abroad for his health, and for 2 years he turned from evangelizing to a pastoral care of that church. And again his gifts in that realm showed themselves. He preached, he counseled, he visited, he held classes for Greek and Hebrew for young men to encourage them in the ministry, and God blessed that church in a way that had never been blessed before. And then it ended. You may not be aware, but 1843 was a year of crisis in Scotland. The Church of Scotland had long been torn by a powerful worldly lobby, imposing unconverted ministers on converted congregations. And the believers in the Church of Scotland had been for a long time feeling that if it went on, they must leave. And in 1843, the disruption, as it's called, took place. 474 out of the 1,203 ministers of the Church of Scotland and their congregations walked out. To them it was a tremendous sacrifice. His own father was one. It meant leaving the manse where they lived, losing their livelihood at once. Their congregations rallied round them and built them a home to live in. His own father had to leave the manse and live in a humble cottage in the town of Kilsyth. And another church was built. But this was a time when faithfulness was called for. To William Chalmers, there was no problem. Two features of his life were prayerfulness and faithfulness. Without hesitation, he left the Church of Scotland. And the Free Church of Scotland was born in that year. But this crisis destroyed the openings for the gospel in Scotland for the time being. And so he preached in England, in Newcastle. He preached in Dublin. He preached in Canada for 2 years. But all the time, in his heart, he knew that this was not what God had called him for. And then, coming back to Scotland in 18, he was now 31. So that was 1846, wasn't it? Yes, 1846, coming back to Scotland from Canada. He prayed again that God would direct him. He'd been preaching in the highlands, in the extreme highlands, and felt that perhaps God wanted him as a missionary there. And he was spending his time learning the Gaelic language. And then a letter came. The English Presbyterian Church wanted a missionary for China. Would he go? They were having a presbytery meeting at Newcastle in 2 weeks' time. Would he go? His sister recalls how he was holding in his hand his Gaelic Book of the Psalms, trying to learn the Gaelic language, when the letter came. He shut the book, he walked over to the bookshelf, and he put it back in the shelf, and he never took it out again. But he got a book on Chinese and began to learn the Chinese alphabet. He went in the 2 weeks to Newcastle, and all the difficulties were put before him. The greater the difficulties, the more was his determination to go. They said to him finally, "When can you go?" He said, "Tomorrow. I've got everything with me." He had his sort of kilt thing, I don't know what they call them, the Scots people had, and a little bag. He never went home again. He went down south, and there, in due time, took a ship to China. But that was William Burns. Whatever his hand found to be done, he did it with all his might at once. Now, in those days, China was not a known country. There were what they called the treaty ports on the coast. Hong Kong had been ceded to Britain, and then going up the coast further, there were places like Canton, Shanghai, Amoy, and so on, a few towns where there were colonies of Westerners there for trade, But the inland China was unknown. The Chinese, that ancient civilization, was bitterly opposed to the Westerns and bitterly opposed to the gospel. And in 1807, Robert Morrison had gone out for the Presbyterians to try to introduce missionary work in China. And he had labored to produce a Chinese Bible and a Chinese dictionary. But that's as far as it was. And that was the China William Burns went to. Now here he was relatively young, 31 years of age. He had been a harvester, a reaper in the gospel. He'd been a man addressing crowds and seeing crowds converted. And now he was to go to a land where for 7 years he would labor and not see one person converted. He was to exchange harvesting to plowing and sowing. And that was to be his life. He started at Hong Kong with some missionaries in Hong Kong, but very soon he moved from the missionary compound to find a little house in the poor part of Hong Kong among the Chinese. And there he began to learn the language. And as soon as he was able, he began to make little excursions across to the mainland with a couple of natives. He would say to them, "Now, I'll leave it to you where we go." And he would take with him in the boat a few Chinese tracts. And he would start itinerating in the villages of China. When we think of China in its vastness, you can see it was just the fringe. But he was the first in that part. He would go to a village, as he had in Scotland when he was preaching, itinerating. He would go to a village, and there he would stand perhaps in the shade of a tree and open his Bible. He had a voice that could be heard, and soon the whole village would gather, and he would read to them. And he would tell them about the God he had come to proclaim. He had no means. He took no means. Lunchtime would come and somebody in the crowd would say, "Where are you eating?" He said, "I don't know." So he'd eat with them. Nighttime would come. "Where are you sleeping?" "I don't know." So he'd sleep where they offered him accommodation. And so he went on from village to village. They said he always came back looking fat and well fed. The Lord provided for him wonderfully that way. But that was how he lived. For most of his life, his salary from the society he gave away, keeping just enough for his own bare necessities, but the rest he would give away to other workers. And so he moved from place to place in China. Time forbids really going into details. From Hong Kong he moved north. Canton he felt impressed with, but after a spell there the doors were shut and he had to leave. He went to Amoy, and there, of course, he had access to water as well. And so he used his gospel boat with its little blue flag. He, writing home to his sister, he tried to describe his gospel boat. He said, "Imagine a blue painted wooden swan, about 23 foot long and 10 foot wide, with a little cabin near one end, 6 foot by four, and one tall mast." Now, he said, "You in Scotland would think the boat very badly shaped. It would never go through the water," he said, "because the Chinese don't intend it to go through the water. They intend it to glide across the water." And he said it would easily cover 7 miles in half an hour, which was quite a speed, I suppose, for a boat like that. But he would then go up inland by water, and then wherever he came to a place to stop, he would get out his little books and his Bible. And so he would travel. And God in this place gave him the only real wave of blessing that he saw in his life in China. Because not far from Amoy there was a place that where the Lord, I pray my knowledge of Chinese is limited, it's nil in fact, so I can't pronounce this name, Pechuya sounds like. But here God began to work. Souls were saved. One young man, a boy of 18, educated, clever with his hands, was a carver of idols, making a living on it. When he heard the word, instead of rejecting it, he embraced it. And soon he was a fervent follower of Christ. His trade had gone, so he turned to carving little ornaments. And he would go with William Burns. As the boat went along, he'd be carving to earn his living. And when they got to where they were going, he would get out and he'd go with him preaching the gospel. He became a valued native evangelist. And this went on. A little church was formed there. But when it was formed, William Burns felt that he must move on. He must move to where the gospel wasn't preached, and so he moved on. Around about this time, he met with Hudson Taylor, a younger man who came out. Hudson Taylor founded the China Inland Mission. And he learned a lot of what he knew from William Burns. And William Burns was blessed by his company. And he noticed Hudson Taylor's native dress and realized he too could be more effective in native costume. As a bachelor, it saved him a lot of needlework and so on, because it was very simple. He describes his wardrobe. It was, I can't just remember, it was only about 3 garments, a pair of socks and a cloak and so on. But they had very happy fellowship working together at that point. As he went along, he met with difficulties, and he showed tremendous wisdom in his handling of people. He was called before a magistrate, and the magistrate ordered him to kneel, as was the custom, on both knees before him. William Burns said, "No, I will not. I will give you the honour that I would give to Queen Victoria. I will bow down on one knee. I only kneel on both knees before the King of Kings." And such was the conviction with which he spoke that the magistrate gave way. He seemed to be able to go through the midst of all manner of opposition without exciting resentment. On one occasion, while he was still living in Hong Kong, there was a disturbance and the crowd were chasing a petty thief. And as they passed his house, somebody called out, "There's no need to go in there, there's only a poor foreigner there." That was what he was known as, the poor foreigner. They saw he was a man who had nothing but the gospel. In his journeys while he was at Hong Kong, on 2 occasions at least, he was robbed of everything he possessed except the clothes he stood up in. One night, while the robbers were ransacking his house and taking everything he had, one of them found the hone with which he sharpened his cutthroat razor. This puzzled him, so he came to William Burns and said, "What's this?" So he said, "Oh, I'll explain." So he demonstrated how to sharpen a razor and then gave it back to the man. When the landlord came in the morning and sympathized with them, he said, "No, there's no need to sympathize. We must pray for those poor fellows." To him, that didn't matter. He had come to bring them the gospel. Later, as his life proceeded, we come to the last stages. In 1863 to 1867, he was in Peking for 4 years. He had gone there with one purpose. The believers in the little church he had left behind near Amoy were being bitterly persecuted. All manner of indignities were being put upon them because they would not worship the idols. Their trees were being cut down, their crops were being pillaged, their animals stolen. One of the leading brethren was denied access to the only well. When his son went to try and get water, he was severely beaten. And this was going on. The police were actually active in it and not protecting it. So he went to see if he could use influence to gain some protection for the Lord's people. And there he spent 4 years, in which he did one of the works dear to his heart. There were missionaries in Peking. There was not much scope for him to work there. With them he had very happy fellowship. He wasn't a recluse. He was a man who lived by himself very simply, but he made it a point that once a week he would go and have tea with one of the missionary families. And there he enjoyed genial, warm company with fellow believers. But we can see him at Peking living in a little house rented with a little enclosed courtyard. They say the summers in Peking are very, very hot, usually in the 90s. The winters are very, very cold, usually 20 degrees of frost with ice a foot thick. There he lived in his little house with its paper window. He had a stove for the winter, and there he would sit summer and winter with a native helper translating Pilgrim's Progress. His great love, Pilgrim's Progress. He translated it. A hymn book. Hymns he translated from his homeland, Scotland. And a book of 50 chapters of Bible doctrine called Peep of Day. I don't know it myself, but it was a book current at the time. The Psalms with notes. And in between his translating, he would make little journeys into the countryside around Peking, preaching, witnessing, Wherever he saw souls needing the gospel, he gave them the gospel. And finally, the end. After 4 years in Peking, he felt a desire to take the gospel north. You see, we're talking of vast distances, Hong Kong in the south and going up north to Peking, but beyond Peking was Manchuria, no missionaries at all in Manchuria. And there was a town to the northeast of Peking, a few hundred miles, where he felt he ought to go with the gospel. He went by junk, the Chinese junk ships. The captain wouldn't take a penny. He said, "No," he said, "I can see that you are going not for gain, but for other purposes. If you were going to make money, you wouldn't travel with me. I won't take any payment." And there he settled in his little house. There was a European community trading and so on. There were believers among them. But he lived among the people. His house was very simple, no luxuries. The form on which he slept, a table, two chairs, two bookcases, a stove, and lighting was through a paper window. That was where he lived. And there he began to witness in the streets. Wherever he could find a hearing, he preached the gospel, and inquiries began to come to his house. And then after 4 months, he fell ill, his last illness. He was attended by his servant, who at that time wasn't a believer. And morning and evening, by his bedside, they had family worship. Inquiries would come to his bedside. And as his illness progressed and his death became very clear to him, he would speak to them. And as the end came near, he said to them on one occasion, "You see in me a proof that the Christian doctrine is true. I am well supported now, and this strength given me not to shrink from death you can take as a proof that the Bible is true. When I am gone, you will not have a missionary. Therefore, you must pray much yourselves, think much, read much, that you may understand well. Let us resolve that we will all meet in heaven." He wrote to his mother, "May the God of consolation comfort you when the tidings of my death reach you. And through the redeeming blood of Jesus, may we meet in heaven with joy before the throne." And he sent her a little slip of paper with the subject matter of his last sermons on his last 12 preaching occasions. The last sermon he preached was from Revelation chapter 20, "And I saw a great white throne." He spoke to his servant. He said, "You are my substitute. My mother, in her letter, says that I am a knife that is worn out by cutting and not by rusting. We shall meet in heaven. Remember that knife. You must be one of God's knives. I'm very happy. I don't fear death. God's promises are true. My work has been little, but I have not knowingly disobeyed one of God's commandments." At his end, he was visited by one of the Europeans from the city, and his last words heard were, "For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory." This was said with intense, unnatural fervor and conviction, and those were his last intelligible words. He'd always said, when people asked him if he was going to China to save the heathen, "No," he said, I'm going to China for the glory of God." His view of the gospel was that his love for souls is only that Christ would be glorified in their salvation. God first. He was a very happy man. He had said, "The happiest state of a Christian on earth seems to be this, that he should have few wants. If a man has Christ in his heart and heaven before his eyes, and only as much of temporal blessing as is just necessary to carry him through life, then pain and sorrow have little to shoot at. Such a man has little to lose. To be in union with him who is the shepherd of Israel, and to walk very near to him who is the sun and shield, That is all a poor sinner needs to make him happy between this life and heaven. That is how William Burns lived. That is how he died. A little later, they gathered all his earthly possessions in a trunk and brought them home. And his brother describes how the trunk was opened before a family of young children. They brought out the contents of all that he possessed in this life: a few sheets of Christian printed matter, a Chinese and English Bible, an old writing case, one or two small books, a Chinese lantern, a single Chinese dress, and the blue flag of the gospel boat. And as these wondering children looked at the sum total of his possessions, one of the little ones was heard to whisper, "He was very poor." But as his brother said, he felt at that moment there was one with them, unseen, who had been poorer than William Burns, that for his sake he might be rich. It's hard to measure the results of his work, because wherever he saw the beginnings of blessing, he moved on and others reaped. But wherever he was known, the influence of his holy, godly life left a lasting mark on all he met. One man asked, a missionary in China asked, "Did he know William Burns?" "Know him," he said. "All China knows him. He was the holiest man alive." So that was a life of a special kind. You and I aren't William Burns's. We have homes, families, work, employment. But that single-mindedness of William Burns could be our portion more than it is. We are to be cutting knives and not rusting knives. And perhaps that would be a little lesson that we could take from the life we've considered. We thank thee, Lord, for these servants of thine, greater far than we can ever be. We thank thee for thy grace evident in their lives. We thank thee for their faith, a pattern for ours. And Lord, we do tell thee that we are very aware of how small and unfit and unworthy we are when measured beside them. But we ask thee to bless what we have thought of tonight, that each one of us, from the youngest to the oldest, may view our lives as bought by precious blood and lives that should be given to our Lord Jesus Christ for his service. Grant us this prayer, we ask, as we separate in his name. Amen.